This is part two of my chat with Martin Beebe about .NET on AWS. In part one, we had a quick introduction as to why .NET is a good choice for AWS, and we talked a little bit about the various services available on AWS. Let's talk a little bit about security, because that felt hard to understand the first few times I was playing with it within AWS.
Yeah, it's a big difference, I'd say. When I came to AWS, the way that security works in AWS is different, and it feels different, and it can feel a bit uncomfortable. And you will very quickly hear words like IAM, or IAM user, or your IAM role. So IAM, or IAM, user or role. And if you've never heard of those things before, you can sometimes be a little bit like, I don't know what that is. And it can be quite confusing. Whereas in the Microsoft world, I used to find that most things were password-based or API key, API secret, API key-based. So let's say one example would be something like Redis. If I create a Redis instance in Azure, you would be given a username and password and like a URL to that Redis instance. In AWS, if I create a Redis instance, I just get the URL. And I don't have a username and password for it. And for me, I was really confused by that. I remember being quite confused. I was like, I don't understand why I'm not given a username and password for this Redis instance. And I asked a colleague of mine who wasn't a .NET person, who just said to me, well, Redis doesn't have like generally a username and password. That's not how security in Redis works. And I was like, yes, it definitely does, because this is the way that I use Redis. And then I later discovered that like that username and password thing is like a thing, an addition that Microsoft have added it into Redis to make it easier for that kind of world where you expect to have a username and password or a security or an API key or a secret to call into services. And the way that it's managed in AWS is that you have the endpoint and then your EC2 instance or your Lambda function, they have a role, and then that role gives them permission to speak to that service. And you can deny or at different levels of granularity to that role, which means that you can change the role's permissions, but you don't have to update the application with a new API key or a new username and password to call that Redis server. You just need to make sure that particular role that instance has that permission. That confused me massively because it wasn't the way that I thought about security. It wasn't the way that I thought about speaking to different services. In Lambda functions, if you want to call our AI services, so let's try and make a comparison. In Microsoft, you have cognitive services, right? And maybe you want to do a vision thing. So you want to send an image and find out all the faces in that image. We have a service in AWS called AWS Recognition. Now, in Azure, you would say, okay, I want to connect to that service and I'm going to provide, I think it gives you an API key with that. And you pass the API key in the request. Well, that's not how it works when it comes to AWS. What you do is that your Lambda function or your EC2 instance has to have a role, and then that role has to have permissions to speak to that service. Now, it's obvious, once you understand IAM and how it roughly works, like it makes perfect sense. But that was a thing which I really struggled with when I first came to AWS. And it's an example, like we can't really change that just for .NET developers because there's so many different services, and like that's how other language users expect AWS to work. But it can be a bit confusing. It really confused me. And now I'm like a couple of years on in AWS and I really like the power of IAM. It's really nice to be able to sort of centrally manage a permission of roles. Or for example, let's say I have like five servers. If all those five servers have the same roles, if I want to give those set of servers permissions to speak to another service, I have to make that sort of change once. I don't have to deploy an API key to all five servers and make sure they're all using the new version. Well, I don't even have to necessarily get it from a sort of a secrets manager or something like that. There's real advantages to doing that, having that model, but if you don't know about that model, it can be a really confusing thing. And that was probably IAM, and the way that security in AWS works is probably one of the most confusing aspects for my shift from the Microsoft world into the AWS world. Yeah, and that's why I always say to anyone, the first thing you should do really is just read a few paragraphs on how IAM works before you try and build stuff in AWS, because you'll save so much time just by having that grounding knowledge about what it is and how that works.
What I found, though, is that you'll read those few paragraphs and you'll be quite confused. And until you've played with it for a while, and even then, you know, I have found what, to my mind, feel like inconsistencies. And you can tell me why I might be wrong about this. So we were chatting a little earlier how to grant permissions to a role, to give a role access to tables, Dynamo tables, it's done at the role. So you go into your role and you say, this role, through a policy, has access to these tables and it can read from them but not write to them.
Yep.
That's, to my mind, that's done at the role. However, when I go over to something like Elasticsearch, I have a JSON piece of text where I'm applying permissions right there to what that role can do to Elasticsearch. And to my mind, it feels like two very, very different ways of granting a role permissions on things. And, you know, from my perspective, again, I'm only at it a few months, that felt like why isn't there one way of doing this?
I'm not quite sure. I'm not that familiar with Elasticsearch, so I'm not really understanding. The consistency for me across the services I use, IAM works in a similar way. You basically have roles and policies, and a policy is basically like a collection of abilities and things that you're allowed to do or not allowed to do, and then you can attach those policies to roles, or the role can actually physically have the abilities attached to it, so you don't actually have to have policies necessarily, but and generally that's the way it works, in that you attach a policy. And most services will come with like a default, you'll often find like a default policy or like a base policy, which kind of gets you started. I'm not quite sure how the Elasticsearch stuff works. I'm interested to go into that. And this is an example, Ryan, where this is exactly the role for me.
Yeah.
Did you say something like that? I've not really played with it too much, so I'll go and take a look at that and see what those inconsistencies are. And then try and find a way, if there is a way, that we could maybe make that easier to understand. Sometimes that's just maybe even just documenting like why there's any confusion or making it easier. One of my favorite things to do is whenever anyone comes to me with a problem they've been wrestling with, is think about what things would they have typed into their search engine to when they face that problem. And then think, well, do our docs show up there? when someone types in IAM confusion with Elasticsearch, like what comes up when you're there?
Yeah, that's a general problem. I must say I have found that when I am trying to do something with a Lambda or with Dynamo or with something, I find that either docs that from on AWS that are perhaps out of date or not very clear. And I told this isn't me with catching Martin now. Martin knew I was going to say this. But for me, docs at Microsoft.com, I have found to be an incredible source of information that's clear and consistent. I would love there to be a docs.aws.com that is as good.
Yeah. Well, I take that on board. And I must say that I've been on the other side of the fence. I think documentation's a tricky one, right?
It is.
Because it's bad. I'm a developer advocate, and the first thing that someone will tell you, whoever you work for, is that docs are bad. And sometimes it's that the docs are bad, and that's completely given. With something like AWS, you generally find that different services, some services have got great docs, and some services don't have great docs. Mm-hmm. Some services are, the services which are really used by .NET developers should have good .NET developer documentation. But there are occasions when you'll have a service which the service team hasn't thought necessarily about the .NET audience. And I discover that occasionally. Like, I write for the AWS news blog. And one of the things that I sort of have in my crib sheet of like things that I want to check is that when someone has a release, like what's the .NET documentation story? Or how does a .NET developer use this? Now, sometimes it doesn't make .NET developers won't use this thing. Like there, it might be a service which is completely outside of the .NET ecosystem, and that's it's nice. Like there's no way of using that necessarily from .NET. But then there might be a there's times when they just haven't given it, you know, thought. And obviously there's people like me for different languages in AWS. So there are advocates which sort of specialize in all different sorts of languages and from different viewpoints. And the hope is that we catch these sorts of things. And there's not just me either, obviously, as a developer advocate for .NET. There's a number of .NET developer advocates at AWS. And our job is trying to find those places where there's mistakes. But I do completely take on board that we could do a better job of documentation. I'll endeavor to try and make that a better thing at AWS, but caveat with the fact that, you know, I don't have the ability to completely rewrite all of our docs. It's something I would love to improve. And just
I can share a few examples with you as well.
Yeah, please do. And also, the other thing is, and this is a problem with docs generally, is like when they were written and the age that they have. Often services will have been written and they might have great docs when they're released, but then things change, patterns change, yeah. You know, the way that people use services change. And you can sometimes stumble across a document which might be from Lambda's quite an old service. It's been around since 2004. I don't want to say the wrong date, but it's about 2014, let's say. You know, if you were trying to use Lambda in 2014 as a C# developer, like it's very different for what it is today because we didn't have first-class support for C#. But you do occasionally get someone which is, you know, looking at a document written in 2014, trying to use modern-day Lambda or a modern-day service, and you know, there's that huge difference between what those two services are nowadays.
I had that problem. I had that exact problem when I was trying to keep a Node Lambda alive when it was making an asynchronous call IO bound, and I found a blog post from probably 2015. But let me move us on a tiny bit. You mentioned the .NET tooling. So if I'm a .NET developer, I'm using VS Code, I'm using Rider, I'm using Visual Studio. What's available to me?
So the best tooling that we have is for Visual Studio. So we have Visual Studio for 2019. 2017, 2015, 2013. I must admit, I don't really know enough about 2013, 2015 tooling. I think it's the same, but 2017, 2019 is the same V6 add-in. I've only recently learned that they're called V6s, by the way. I used to call them VSIXs before, or VSIXs, you know, but they're called V6 things. And they, like, you install the AWS toolkit for Visual Studio 2019, and it will basically bring alive lots of features, AWS features. So we have a thing called the AWS Explorer, and you can explore your AWS account. You can do things like, if you've got an ASP.NET application, you can right-click the project and you can publish to AWS Elastic Beanstalk, which is the service that you probably would want to run that onto. If we discover a Docker file inside of your application, if you right-click the project, you can publish the container to AWS and you could publish it to one of our different, we've got a few different container services. So it sort of enables you to sort of have an AWS workflow from within Visual Studio. And I would say our support is best inside of Visual Studio. And then more recently, we've added support for a couple of other IDEs. But largely, that support has been is around serverless. So whilst you can, the support in Rider and VS Code does have other capabilities and features, you'll find that it's very serverless. It comes from a very serverless angle. And that, you know, it's easy to create a serverless project and create serverless lambdas and start writing Lambda functions in there. But the Visual Studio tooling does all that Lambda stuff, but it also has a much greater array of services that are covered from within the IDE.
So as an example, with the Lambda one in, say, VS whatever, Code or Rider or Studio, can you give you a template and then help you generate test parameters that we passed in the way you could with the AWS UI console?
Yes, so you can. The Rider ones, I use Rider, so more than VS Code, but I believe they're comparable in terms of their capabilities. What you do when I produce a Rider one is, and this is actually the same as Visual Studio as well, we right-click file, sort of file new project, and we'll go into the, once we've installed the add-in, you can go to the AWS section, and there's a few templates in there. One of them will be a serverless application. And I think we have a few templates in there. The one I usually use is the serverless application with tests. And what that will do is it will produce a serverless application, and it will also produce a test project for you as well. And so you can test the Lambda functions locally for unit testing. But actually, that it's good that it has that, because knowing how to unit test Lambda functions isn't as obvious as you might think. It is obvious when you see it, but it's a good that they've included that, because there's a certain pattern that you can follow to make that easier. And it's not obvious as to how you would do that. If you had to start from scratch, you wouldn't necessarily know, how do I unit test a Lambda function? It gives you a good example of how you would unit test a Lambda function. And then we have like a local deploy. So you can use, it uses Docker, and it basically runs some infrastructure on your machine, which looks a little bit like Lambda. And then you can deploy the functions and test them, and they give output. So you can sort of test Lambda functions without any kind of connection to the cloud. And then you can obviously actually end up deploying it to AWS. So you can right-click the project, you right-click the template actually and deploy it. And it's not just like one single Lambda function. We have this thing called the serverless application model, which is basically infrastructure which is serverless in serverless applications. So that's things like AWS Lambda, things like DynamoDB, which we mentioned earlier, things like API Gateway, which is another service to now enable you to put a web front end in front of a server, a HTTP endpoint in front of a Lambda function. And so you can construct all of that. And in this SAM template, you right-click the SAM template, you can just deploy that to AWS, and it will then create all the infrastructure for your application. So there's loads of different places and ways that you can test your Lambda functions, from, you know, completely offline in Docker containers, to unit testing, to deploying it live into your account. I would say, generally speaking, Visual Studio tooling is most of the services that AWS people are going to be interested in. The Rider add-in, which was only about a year old actually, we added that, and we generally support the sort of serverless application model. Although it does have things in there to like create S3 buckets from within the IDE and do those sorts of things. But I think the expectation is people which are in Rider and in VS Code are usually quite comfortable going out to a CLI and interacting with AWS that way. And so we haven't added necessarily so much of the support directly in the IDE. But with Visual Studio, I think people do expect it to be in the IDE in menu options, and that to be a very UI-driven workflow. So, yeah, we have support for those tools.
You touched upon it there, and it's the next topic I wanted to talk about, the infrastructure as code. I've recently started using Pulumi because they've released a C# interface to their underlying system. For people who don't know, Pulumi is an infrastructure as code company. You can build infrastructure as code in TypeScript, Python, Go, C#, and I think maybe one other language. That's a pure .NET C# way of deploying any infrastructure on AWS. But what I didn't know about, and you can tell us, is that there was something on AWS called the Cloud Development Kit.
Yep.
What is that? How does it compare to, say, Pulumi?
It's a very similar project, I guess, in some ways. It's, as you describe it, it's infrastructure as code, but infrastructure in a language rather than in YAML or JSON. So I think it's quite common that, you know, if you're using Terraform or ARM templates or CloudFormation, you're writing JSON or YAML to describe your infrastructure. And as a developer, that can be quite, I find it really painful, actually. I've never written any of those templates by hand, really. What the CDK is attempting to do is it allows you to create infrastructure in AWS using the language of choice, your language of choice. Our tool's actually built in TypeScript. So the way that you get the tool, the way you install it is by using NPM, and you install this CDK tool. But then you can generate a project in one of our supported languages. And I can't remember exactly all of the supported languages, but we have a .NET version, we have a Java version, Python, JavaScript, and TypeScript. And I think not quite sure. That's roughly the languages. I think there might be another one. But it means that you can create the infrastructure in your language, in the language that you like. Oh, and PowerShell as well. So people can use PowerShell for, actually, we've not released that. But there's a version of PowerShell on GitHub that you can see, which is
by the time the podcast comes out, it'll probably be released.
Well, I'm not complete. So yeah, PowerShell is something which we've been working on, but definitely like C Sharp. So C Sharp, the idea is that you can you write to create your infrastructure, you know, as like a program effectively. So if I wanted to create an S3 bucket, it would be, I would say var bucket equals, and then I'd use we call them constructs, but it's just a piece of C# code, which uses these little modules, which we call constructs. And then you can say, I want an S3 bucket, and it will create an S3 bucket for you. And then you could say, on the next line, I want to create a Fargate service, and then I want to create a container, and I want to add that container to my Fargate service. And so basically you start describing your application. So you write it all as one big C# application. And once you're happy with it, then you go into your command line and you type CDK deploy. It compiles the application. And at that point, it actually pushes your infrastructure into your AWS account. And under the hood, we use a thing called CloudFormation, which is like our infrastructure as code service. But you're writing it in C#. So it's the way that I write all of my AWS infrastructure now is I use the CDK. I think it's the easiest way to create infrastructure. And the cool thing about it is it's repeatable. So if I write a particularly nice piece of C#, which creates me a load balanced Fargate service or something like that, I can then take that piece of code, wrap it up in a module, and then deploy that out to other people, and they can use it as a construct. So I can write a package for them. They can import it as a NuGet package, and then they can start using my higher level construct. And so you end up with these, like, I've got a little set of libraries of things that I commonly build, and in a couple of lines of code, I can generate all these different pieces of infrastructure. I find it's a really interesting way of writing infrastructure, and I prefer it massively to something like YAML or to JSON. And it's a very similar thing to Pulumi, I guess, but Pulumi is obviously a third-party tool. Yeah.
I had a quick look at the CDK, and it does look similar to Pulumi, and I suppose one of the big differences I've been using Terraform, but there are times when I want to do something programmatically. I have an example, again, going back to my Elasticsearch. I want, when I'm kind of testing with it, testing and playing with it, I want to include my IP address as an allowed address on it. Trying to do that with Terraform would probably not be easy, or may well be impossible. Whereas with C#, all I have to do is go find my IP address via public API and then include that in my infrastructure as code. It's a trivial programming step. And that's one of the, I suppose, the wonderful things. Or if you wanted to pull configuration from a database, or you wanted to pull it from anything at all, you have the full C# language at your disposal. You know, and with Terraform, even things like a loop or an if statement are not easy, if possible at all, even.
Well, let's say the other thing which is really common is, let's say you wanted to create one piece of infrastructure, like a user role, for example, and then you wanted to apply that to multiple things. Like you've created a bucket which you want to add that role to, an EC2 instance that you want to add that role to. In a Terraform sort of, in a YAML or JSON thing, you would, you know, have to create it, then you get the output, and then you'd have to, you know, it's like you have to then apply that to all the different things. If I'm doing it in a language, I just have to create that object. I've got the bucket object, and then I reference that object you know, when I'm creating other pieces of infrastructure. So you can sort of, you can make references to different pieces of infrastructure that you're creating, and use things like objects and loops and the sort of power of a language. So you don't have to go through and do what you commonly do with a infrastructure as code document. If you want to make a change where you have to sort of change the references of a name once, but then maybe you have to, you know, grep the file and change it lots of different places or whatnot. You can, you, it's a proper programming language, which means that if you miss, if you make a change to one of your pieces of infrastructure, you don't accidentally miss something by not typing it correctly.
Yeah, you'll get a compile failure. Yes.
You'll get a compile failure. Yeah, yeah,
which is, as I've done when I disable Kinesis because Kinesis costs money and I want to turn it off for the night, but I also still left it attached to my Lambda function, and I kind of go, oh, look, it didn't compile. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then one other thing that Pulumi is doing is that they're offering an import option where you can point Pulumi to AWS and say, pull down the C# of the infrastructure that I built by hand. So like by hand, I mean, you go into the console, you would create a cluster, you'd create a service, you'd create a gateway. You can point it at all that and reverse engineer it down to C#. It's a feature that is only coming out. We're recording this at the end of October, so it only came out a few weeks ago. So it's still not as polished as it could be, but by the time this podcast comes out, I think it'll be pretty much ready.
Yeah, I'll be interested to look at that. It sounds like a really cool idea. The other thing with CDK as well is that it's obviously it's evolving an awful lot. They actually have added CDK for Terraform as well. So if you come from a Terraform world, you're able to use CDK constructs for defining Terraform HCL state, which you know, I'm not from a Terraform background, but it's interesting that they've added that because obviously there's been a customer demand for it. And also the other thing as well is if you've ever used Kubernetes, there's a like an API that you have to call and so you interact with generally. And so when you're creating, we always found when we were using CDK to create Kubernetes, you had this weird sort of scenario where you were wanting to interact with a Kubernetes thing, but you were trying to build it with CDK. It didn't quite fit. The jigsaw puzzles didn't quite fit. So there's another project called CDK 8, which is, again, by the same CDK team at AWS, which is a for Kubernetes users. So there's different angles into the CDK. I would say it's a very ambitious project in that it's got lots of language supports. It's got different ways in. And obviously, it's quite a complicated thing to explain in a podcast form. But it's definitely take a look. It's a it's an interesting project.
And on that point of take a look, as, let's say, a listener, a .NET developer, who wants to get started with AWS,
yeah,
you have a free tier. Can you tell a little bit about that, or what would one do to get going?
I mean, if you just go to the AWS website, you'll get prompted very quickly for do you want to sign up for a free tier? I mean, hopefully, if our web marketing people are doing a good job of it. Now, our free tier includes different things. We have things which are free for 12 months. We have things which are always free, and we have trials. So it's a bit of a mixed bag of different things that you can get in AWS. It's certainly enough to experiment with AWS and try different things out. And you can get started with bits and pieces. But you should sort of note that there are certain things in there which are not free. So it's not a complete free, everything's free for all use. So you should check the service that you'll want to use and just see what the capabilities of that. For example, let's say Lambda. If you create an invocation in Lambda is like you know, you call a Lambda function, that's one invocation, roughly, right? So you get, I think, a million invocations free always with the Lambda service. But then there's things like in the free tier, if you sign up for the free tier, you get something like EC2, you get 750 hours of EC2. Per month to use. So if you wanted to spin up a virtual machine, you could do that, for example. So there's lots of, the free tier covers lots of things, but we have a lot of services, and some of those services are included and some of them are not. So you should just check with the tier. I'm not going to pretend that it's like the perfect free tier. It's enough to get you going and enough to get you started with AWS.
It certainly is. So in my experience, the only thing that I'm using right now that costs money is Kinesis. It isn't highlighted incredibly well that, you know, hey, Brian, you're a free tier. This one costs a little bit, but it was there. And then you have the Cost Explorer, and I think I've racked up 16 cents in my experiments, which isn't going to be a problem. But I also didn't use it very much. It was more that I accidentally left it on for about 4 hours when I had meant to turn it off.
Okay, now I will say something. If you ever leave anything on accidentally at AWS, and you genuinely did it accidentally, raise a support ticket and we'll refund the money. Like, it's not, I, for example, created an SFFTP service, and I left it on for a secure FTP service that we have. I created one just for a demo, and then I left it on in my account for a long period of time, and I had a very sort of like expensive version of it, and got this bill, and I was like, well, what do I do with this? Because it was on my personal AWS account, not my work AWS account. And I spoke to my boss, and he said, look, be a customer and see what the support is like for a customer which has that problem. And so I went through the regular support systems and opened a ticket, explained that I'd not actually used this service. I accidentally left it on, and they gave me my money back. And I think that, speaking to customers, if it's genuinely a genuine mistake that you make, we don't want to discourage you from using our service because of a mistake that you've made. And our engineers will be able to tell if you're actually actively using it in production or not. And so the support team were very good with me. And I'm hoping that for all of our customers, they didn't know that I would work for AWS when I applied for that. So if you ever do, and that actually doesn't just go for AWS, like, do that for any cloud. If you ever get a cloud bill, which is accidental, you should always contact your vendor and make sure and your cloud provider and say, look, this was a mistake. And I'm pretty sure across the board that cloud companies generally will refund you.
Any final notes before we wrap up on a very late night for you, approaching 2 a.m.?
No, I just encourage people to go take a look. And if you do come across things that, even if you don't want to progress with AWS, but you come across something and you say, actually, you know, this could be better, do try and let someone at AWS know, like, let me know. I'm at the Biebs on Twitter. Just tweet me, DM me, however you want to get in contact with me, and just tell me, like, what was uncomfortable for you? What made you like it or not like it? I'd be really intrigued, because the more feedback we can get like that, the more we can improve the service and the better we can get.
Well, Martin Beebe, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you very much.
If you like this episode, you should also check out part one of this discussion with Martin Beebe. That's episode 152. Or episode 150 with Luke Hoban on Pulumi, the infrastructure as tool code we talked about during this podcast. Or episode 132 with Lars Klint, where we talk about a cloud-first approach. Thank you. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Lavender by Sergei Cheremizinov from the album Movement.